He see that he was the reason I couldn't be? When the onus of survival is put upon a child, surely that hinders her ability to go play with a doll like other good little girls. I could lay that squarely at my father's feet. Going back through my life, I can see why my father lived his life differently. It was a reaction to how he was raised. Well, that in a uniquely special kind of mind. His father, my grandfather, James Robert McGowan, was an American patriot and Navy man through and through. He was complex, alcoholic, and tough. Grandpa Jim had 5 children under the age of 8 when he went to fight in Korea. His wife, Nora, a mentally fragile beauty from Quebec, Canada, was left to raise the kids alone while he was at war. When Grandma Nora found out that Grandpa Jim had a Korean lady on the side, her occasional bouts of mental illness became intractable. At least that's what my dad told me. The Navy committed her to their psych ward, and involuntary electroshock therapy followed. It was early days for that kind of therapy. Grandma Nora was a guinea pig. During this period, chaos reigned in my father's childhood home. My dad and his siblings would alternate wearing the one pair of shoes they had. Only the child wearing the shoes could get to school and have a hot meal. It breaks my heart to think of them taking little forged notes from a parent, written in child scrawl, asking the grocer to please give them bread that would be repaid later. A gang of men broke in one night when they were alone and ransacked the house. The children hid in the refrigerator. I would like to say I can't imagine their terror, but it wouldn't be true. I can relate to the instability, hunger, raging mental illness, and its fallout. These are all old friends of mine and my family's. I would later come to understand that my father was most likely manic depressive. The manic side was the magical side, the bright, funny, wild side, cackling at the wheel of our car as we skidded around the mountain roads. The depressive side was the monstrous, violent side. The more overwhelming his life got, the more the dark side won out. He had fallen into doing heroin at one point in the early 70s in Venice, California. I think that's where he met the people from Children of God and how he got clean. And then his new drug became Jesus. He was like a rock star, and Jesus became the instrument he played. Had he gotten help earlier in life, it would no doubt have saved my relationship with him and his relationship with my brothers and sisters, his relationship with art, his relationship with the world, with women, probably with everything. As for my mother, with her porcelain skin, long, reddish, blonde hair and blue eyes, she was a magnet for the wrong kind of boy. And the wrong kind of boys turned into the wrong kind of men. She ran away by the age of 15. At 18, she met my father, Daniel. By 19, she was pregnant and in a cult. While my mother was pregnant with me, her mother, Sharon, climbed the Three Sisters Mountain in Oregon and tragically slipped, plummeting to her death. She was 37. I was told that's why I'd always be sad, because my mother was sad during my pregnancy. For years, I thought my intense internal sadness was due to this, but later I realized it had more to do with brain chemistry. Sharon, with her beautiful red hair and green eyes, had also married young, a bad match. I've blocked out my grandfather's name, her husband. I suppose I could find out, but I frankly don't care to. The mores of the time being what they were, a damaging blanket of silence covered all intransigence. The dying gasps of the Kennedy era and the pervasive requirements of feminine civility and perfection have in their way fascinated me for as long as I can remember. The stifled rage must have been a constant for women of that era, not knowing that in a few short years everything would change. I can't even imagine how much rage I would have had to stifle back then, because I've had to stifle so much now. My mother impresses me greatly. I truly think she's one of the most intelligent people I've ever met. Her mind works at a very fast RPM, like a Ferrari brain. She is a beautiful woman. And she was preyed upon. Maybe that, besides an agile mind, was what got handed down to me. But I'm grateful for many other things handed down to me from my family. A dissenting punk spirit, a quick, cruel wit, curiosity, love of history, and above all, a love of words. One of the great things that both my mother and my father gave me is this ability to see art everywhere. I fantasize about having tetrachromacy, where you can see over a million colors. I see shapes and patterns in everything. I'm always surprised that when people grow up in a more traditional way, sometimes they don't seem to be able to see, to really see the things all around them that are pure art. To me, that is what makes the experience of life. It's also something that helped me survive. For all the flaws of my childhood, I consider myself lucky to have been raised with a European sensibility. We had Italy and its history, its architecture and its art. I think Europe and older cultures have a different sense of rhythm and time. I find the system, especially the system I now know best, the American system, aggressively determined to crush free thought in those it labels other. I'm here to tell you that other is where it's at. People tell me they're sorry for how I spent my childhood. That's cool. I simply tell them I'm sorry for how they live. Growing up behind the proverbial white picket fence frankly seems as dangerous to me and a different kind of cult. The cult of the mainstream. I've known some fucked up people behind those picket fences. At least with my family, it was all right there to see. One of the great benefits of growing up, moving a lot, and continuing to do so as I got older was that I met people who thought differently, and in that way, I was raised to view the world from a different perspective. I am grateful for that, if anything. I was also bequeathed the one thing that runs strongest in my family. A strong urge to destroy oneself. The phoenix that has to rise because life has turned to ashes. My life has ashed itself numerous times, more times than I can count. But goddamn, all those ashes built a beast. I know I am not alone in this life-ashing thing. So many of us seem to have this preternatural ability to rise because we have no other choice. It's something that fascinates me about the human spirit. I think our rising is the bravest thing we can do, and I don't think people give themselves enough credit for it. How many times have we been told we'd be nothing? But we are not nothing. We are phoenixes and we rise. All it takes is some bravery. Turning our lives around is the bravest thing we can do. One step at a time, first we walk, then we run. One of the things people don't realize about cults is that they're all over. It's not just wild-haired cult leaders. Of course, it was extreme in the Children of God when they began advocating sex with children and the selling of women, viewing them as merchandise and property. But when it comes down to it, this mentality wasn't far from what I would later experience in Hollywood and the world at large. At least with Children of God, I knew what I was running from. Hollywood and media messaging was a lot more insidious. I have patches of memory from the night we escaped the commune. Like a movie scene, it comes in flash images. I remember asking my father where my mother was. No answer. I remember the running, holding my father's hand, and the green corn-like plants with their hard stalks whipping my small face, the lightning, thunder, and rain raging in the night sky. Sometimes in the movies it rains to heighten the drama. Well, this drama was heightened. The rain was pouring. Ironic, then, that after Italy, my father would send me to the perpetually rainy American Pacific Northwest as my next home. American Girl. It was in the bathroom of the plane taking me to America that I remember first really seeing myself in a mirror. I didn't really know what I was staring at because I had no attachment to the face I was staring at. I didn't know that once I got off that plane, I would land in a world of here's what you can't do because you're a girl, and here's why you're different and fucked because you're a girl. It was like a pink school uniform for the mind. The first place I was sent was a small-town naval base. I went from Florence, Italy to Gig Harbor, Washington. Or to be more blunt, I essentially went from the cradle of Western civilization to a place with rednecks and jacked-up trucks with big wheels. America was terrifying. Loud. Jarring. I hated the food instantly. I hated how aggressive people were. My brother and I were sent ahead of my father to live with my step-grandmother, Dorothy, yet another adult I didn't know but was supposed to attach to. She was a tall brunette cigarette smoker with a big throaty laugh. She loved America. She talked about it a lot. My first night in the USA was spent in terror of the bear she told me might eat me in the night. The only thing she knew how to cook was boiled tomatoes, and I cried because I missed the food in Italy. I was taken to Denny's, a chain restaurant with frankly terrible food, the worst that American cuisine has to offer. They had a big menu with pictures on it. I was so excited to see spaghetti on the menu, I started speaking excitedly in Italian and waving my hands around. When it arrived, it was a gelatinous blob. I stared at it, picked it up with a fork, and instead of being normal pasta, it stayed together as one unit. There was also a big lake of lukewarm water underneath the spaghetti blob. I just started crying because I knew my life was never going to be the same again. I had landed in a world of tater tots and cheese whiz, and there was no going back. Fuck. Everything was different. Not just the food, but the land, the trees, the sounds. It rained all the time in this new place. The cars were so big and so loud. The people were so big and so loud. I had never even seen wooden houses. In Italy, all the houses had been made of stone. I had never been around Americans. I had never heard music piped through loudspeakers. My brother and I huddled together when announcements blared out in the supermarket. We'd never seen fluorescent lights. We'd never seen orange cheese. Dear America, why is your cheese orange? Who decided, let's make this an unnatural shade of orange? It's completely arbitrary. My brother and I thought it was hilarious. We'd point our fingers and snicker. But the joke was on us. We were stuck there. My first day in American school, I was made to stand in front of the class and lead them in the Pledge of Allegiance. I didn't know what the Pledge of Allegiance was. I could understand English. I just refused to speak it. I heard the teacher say, "This will get the communist out of her." I turned to the teacher and uttered just one word. Fascistas. Fascists. That's what the Italians were during the war, you dummy, not communists. Indeed, it seemed the welcome message was unmistakable. You're different. We must crush the difference out of you. There's a tenacious myth that America glorifies individualism, but trust me, if you are a true individual, you will be persecuted. Schools force-feed you the propaganda version of the world and its history, the bullshit version, so that by the time you graduate, you're chanting along with everyone else, "America, hell yes, white men are number one." Why? Why do you say America is number one? Because if you actually look at the statistics around the world, America is not, in fact, number one at anything anymore. Except maybe obesity, firearm deaths, the death penalty, and incarceration rates. Oh, and of course, military might and our other big export, American film and television. This is when reactionaries start yelling about how other countries are worse, so why don't I go live there, etc., etc. My view is, why not just be better? Why should we continue to feel superior just because other places are worse? That sounds like bad logic to me. We can just be better by thinking differently. Thinking whatever is different about you must be stripped from you is the wrong way to approach things. Thinking you must be homogenized for everybody else's comfort level because, God forbid, discomfort is the wrong way too. Fuck those ways of thinking. Do not bend yourself to make others feel taller. When I arrived at school, they said to me, "Stop reading what you're reading. This is what you're allowed to read because you're X. Stop doing what you're doing. Girls can't do that." The adults I met were dedicated in their pursuit of beige. Not all, but most. Our neighbors had no interest in being intrigued or expanded by an alternative lifestyle or viewpoint. They didn't want to know what else might exist out there in the world. They just wanted to kill it because it was different. I longed for my dad and his strangeness. I needed an antidote. Fast. After a few months, my brother and I were flown to a state called Colorado to reunite with my father. Colorado is one of the most beautiful places on earth. We lived in a little wooden house at the base of a majestic mountain in a mostly hippie community, a town called Evergreen. I loved Colorado, even if I still was not a fan of American food. Soon after, my new stepmother arrived, and life in Colorado was mostly good. I adjusted to my new life better in this freer environment than I had living by the naval base. I had come to love Colorado, even if I didn't understand a lot of the social cues of my school peers. At least I was treated well by the teacher, so that was a nice change. Around this time, I found a book on astral projection. Astral projection is a practice of essentially leaving your body behind and traveling by spirit. I would lie in bed and practice my hardest to get out of my body. I wanted to travel and find my mother. My mother was still in Italy, and unbeknownst to me, was making her way back to America to a state called Oregon. Later, I would find out that my dad essentially left her behind to get out of Children of God on her own. Her only living relatives were her sister and her grandmother, Vera. Grandma Vera sent her the money to get home and help my mom restart her life in traditional society. One day, I was told I'd be going to Oregon that night to join my mother. I was excited at first before I understood that Oregon was not going to be a happy place for me. Looking back, I have to say, I am incredibly impressed with my mom. She made it back from Italy, raised 6 kids on no money, occasionally surviving on food stamps while my dad was living with his new wife. My mom had 6 kids not because she had really wanted to, but because the cult had encouraged her to. To me, it seemed she was embarrassed about her life. Even now, I know she dislikes it when I talk about the cult, but to me, it's not her shame. It's just an alternative adventure that she went on. There's no shame that should be hers. Plus, I'm certain it was my father's idea. When my mother landed back in America, her grandmother helped her get government housing. These houses were pretty basic compared to the prettier home I lived in with my father, but I was ecstatic to be reunited with my mother and other siblings. Unfortunately, as the oldest girl, I got the shaft. I had to be mom junior. I was 10. Taking care of a gang of wild children is not easy when you're a kid. I didn't want to be a substitute mom. I was not suited for it because I like to think too much and get agitated when I can't. I need quiet. I didn't want to be the enforcer. I wanted to go and stare at the clouds. My style of child rearing was not with the best bedside manner, to put it mildly. I was getting angrier and angrier at the circumstances of my life. My powerlessness. I knew I had to help my mom, and I did, but I was not cheerful about it. Oregon was where I learned to understand the value of a dollar. I discovered what it's like to struggle and be embarrassed when you leave the free food line at church with your block of bright orange cheese. The sadistic school receptionist called our names out over the loudspeaker so everyone in the school could laugh at the poor kids who had to claim free lunch tickets. I'll never forget the sneer on the receptionist's smarmy face when I had to pick up my tickets. Complete classism. I resented those lunch tickets, not to mention the disgusting food. I scalped the tickets on the side to make a little profit. I've always been very entrepreneurial. Things were going somewhat okay in Oregon, which was to say, hard. Then I met a guy named Lawrence. He lived down the street from us. He had caught me sneaking under his fence to feed his dog bread and give it water. The dog was tied up, chained to a tree. His collar was so deeply embedded in his throat that it had maggots all around it. This was a severely abused animal, which should have given some indication of Lawrence's character. He caught me feeding his dog and threw me out of his yard by the strap of my overalls. I landed on my ass. I hated him instantly. 2 weeks later, I got home, and who should be sitting in a chair in our living room but Lawrence, with his fat belly making everybody wait on him hand and foot like he was king of the castle. I walked in the door, and he looked at me with a sadistic smile. I froze. He said, "Hi, Rose. Call me Dad." I remember just screaming, "No," and running into the field that was behind our house, hiding there. Soon after, he moved in with his 2 daughters, Autumn and Mary, and his son, Larry, Jr. Lawrence Sr. was charming at first, but I wasn't falling for it. I knew what his dog looked like. I knew the hell this man could bring. He was truly evil, and he had my mom snowed. I kept desperately trying to tell her, but she wouldn't or couldn't listen to me. Despite the fact that she'd escaped Children of God and its patriarchal structure, the societal programming that a man was going to save her was so deeply embedded she couldn't see the truth. She was probably also lonely. My mom didn't have any girlfriends because she was so busy with so many kids and working full time. Probably the first time I ever saw anything sexual was walking to my mom and Lawrence's bedroom. I didn't even understand what was going on when suddenly a shoe was thrown at me. That was my introduction to sex, a shoe to the head. As it turned out, my creepy new faux dad was molesting his daughter Mary. We found out years later when she bravely brought charges against him. I always felt something was really wrong, though, instinctively. Mary, who was about 14 at the time, and I were forced to take baths together while Lawrence watched. Having only recently met her, it was distressing for me. I knew something was off about this and hid myself as much as I could. We would both huddle and turn away. Apparently Lawrence liked blondes, and thank God I had dark hair. But I saw him looking at my sister Daisy, who was blonde. Sometimes she would walk down the hall, and I would see him stand up and start following her. I would block his path and get in his face. Well, I would get in his stomach, because I was 10. One particular time I spit at him, and it landed perfectly on his lips. He gave me a beating, and I took it. I was damned if I was going to let him do anything to Daisy. One of my proudest achievements is keeping her safe from him. But there was only so much I could do to protect my sisters and brothers during this period. I did my best. My youngest brother, Robbie, was 3 and a half, so cute and so pretty. He rode his big-wheel tricycle down the street, and for some reason it set Lawrence off. Lawrence marched out, took spiky rose bush branches, and beat my little brother until he was bleeding all over his back and his bum. Outside of the house, Lawrence made his son and daughter forcibly hold me up and made me look through the window to watch him as he beat my brother. I had never hated anyone more. Lawrence would find other sick ways to rile me up. He knew I hated the N-word, and he would get in my face and say it over and over until I lashed out at him. So then he had an excuse to beat me with his belt buckle. Now I look at 10-year-olds, and I think, Jesus, they're small. I was small. Lawrence listened in on the line when we had our weekly phone call with my father to make sure we didn't tell him what was going on. He monitored the mailbox, too, so we couldn't send any letters for help. It drove me insane that this worthless human had power and control over me. The beatings were one thing, but silencing me was his favorite thing and what I hated him for the most. He punished me by not allowing me to speak for a month. I was not allowed to utter a word. I felt so violated. I have had my voice stolen many times since, but that was a big one because it was so literal. I have no idea what I did to get grounded off speaking. Knowing me, it was probably for talking back. When it was mealtime, I would look across the table at my mother, beseeching her with my eyes, trying to get her to intervene, but there was nothing to be done. Having a voice and being heard is a fundamental human right. And this indignity set a kind of pattern in my life. After a while, my mom did try to break up with him numerous times. She'd say it was over and that he was gone for good, and I'd get my hopes up, but then he'd be back. One night, he drove around in his pickup truck with a shotgun, threatening to kill my mom. I hid in the back of the truck, and when I caught sight of her running, I'd shout warnings. He's coming from the left. He's coming from the right. Go right. Finally, after that, she broke up with him for good. Abusive relationships are no joke and extremely hard to escape, but she did it. Later, my mother found out he'd done terrible things to all these other women he'd been with before and after her. He'd gotten off every single time in court, playing the system. He even got off the molestation charges. The cops loved him. He got off all the time. No one would listen. Eventually, Lawrence kidnapped his son's girlfriend and raped her across 3 states in the cab of his truck, holding a shotgun on her. He was finally arrested and sentenced to jail time. I hope he's dead. I hope someone drove a stake through his heart. I think of how many kids are abused and how heartbreaking it is that no one helps them. And then it just begets more abuse. I don't know where Lawrence's kids are today. Poor Mary. I hope that girl is still alive, and I hope she's doing okay. I hope her and her siblings haven't had their lives totally ruined. I remember thinking as a young girl, how is it possible that women can be so gullible? They just ignore the reality of what is happening and believe what they want to believe. I think women in general, and my mom for sure, got sold this bill of goods, the story that a man will save them. I don't think that's really changed even for girls today. We're still getting sold the same story. I had to unpack it because later even I was ensnared in an abusive relationship. We need to look at why so many women believe a man is going to save us. It's not because of evidence of saving. I haven't seen a lot of dudes on white stallions pulling up to single women's homes. In fact, I have seen most women get on their own damn stallion. It's just male-dominated society that snows us into not noticing it's we women doing the saving. We are the white stallion, and we have to wait for no one but ourselves. Even though I had these early experiences with men who were horrible beasts, I still somehow got it imprinted in me that a powerful man was going to come along and make my life easier. In reality, they usually just complicated things. Even though rationally I knew it wasn't true, there had always been this feeling deep inside of me that I was bad, and men were somehow the superior ones. I was bad because I was tempting. I was bad because there was want attached to me. Lawrence was truly a psychopath, probably the first true psychopath that I met. I would go on to meet others, but he set the mold. There's a direct correlation between my relationship with my father and Lawrence, and later on, my relationship with men for the rest of my life. Runaway thinker. Everyone thinks Oregon is full of peace-loving hippies. Not the people I was around. They had jacked-up trucks, boosted up with big wheels, and gun racks in the back windows. There were dead deer hanging upside down from practically every carport with blood draining into a bucket. I have never, in all the places I've been in a place more happily vicious than Oregon. I know others have had different experiences there, and I am glad for them. It just wasn't my experience. People had severe reactions to me there. They went out of their way to tell me I was strange and hideous. I remember encountering a mother in the Fred Meyer department store. She must have been about 30, a grown woman, who jerked her little girl away from me when I smiled at her, calling me an ugly freak. Her daughter started to cry. I decided to go and see what it was she saw. What was it about me that was ugly? I went into the bathroom and stared at myself in the mirror. My eyes looked even. My nose did, too. I couldn't figure out what it was. I had short hair, but what was wrong with that? One day when I was about 11, walking down the street in Santa Clara, a suburb on the outskirts of Eugene, I heard some really awful rock music and a loud car exhaust. I knew this was a bad combination, and I was proved right. "Freak!" the guy in the car yelled. I ignored him and kept walking. Next thing I knew, I was hit in the head and covered with a brown liquid, wet from my head down to my toes. The car sped off. As I wiped at my eyes, I saw a giant plastic bottle of Pepsi with its top jaggedly cut off. Then I noticed the stink rising. The bottle was the driver's chew spit. It was like the movie Carrie, where she's doused in blood, except for I was doused in nicotine and saliva mixed with some old soda. I didn't cry. I just sighed and went home to hose myself off. The chew nicotine smell didn't leave me for a week. Every time the air moved around me, I could smell the hate. My father was still living in Colorado at this time, and my parents decided I was to go back to Evergreen and live with him again. We kids bounced back and forth fairly often as there was no formal custody agreement. It was such a strange dichotomy. I went from Oregon, where I was relentlessly deemed hideous and ugly and freakish, to Evergreen, where I was suddenly popular and considered a beauty. This was a strange development. I looked in the mirror again and stared at the same eyes, nose, and mouth, and wondered why before, when I had been in another state, I'd had things thrown at me, and here I was being worshipped and anointed with instant popularity. I thought about it deeply and came to the conclusion that other humans' reactions were useless to me. Ultimately, it allowed me to cancel out what other people thought of me. Later on, when fame came, this deduction probably saved my sanity. In the meantime, I was handed one more mindfuck on my very first night back at my father's when I told him what had gone on with Lawrence. He simply said to me, "Well, you made a mistake. You should have sent me a letter from your school." The idea had never occurred to me. That effectively shut that conversation down and made the whole situation somehow my fault. The two sides of my father became more pronounced. His light side was still magical. He made things fun simply because of how he reacted to the world. My father had a laugh that sounded like this crazed hyena, and just when you thought it would stop, it would continue, and everybody else around him would start laughing too. I can still hear it today. But at this point, the dark side was starting to appear more regularly. He was getting angrier and angrier that the little girls in the family were growing up and not so worshipful. That included his wife. He was having more flashes of rage and becoming more and more cruel. Eventually, I had to go back to Oregon to my mom. A few years later, I was attending Madison Junior High, my least favorite school in my spotty scholastic career. In eighth grade, I went to my first and only school dance. It took place in a squat brown building with bad lighting and cheap decorations. I was skirting around the edges of the room on the sidelines of the crowd when I heard a gravelly voice say, "Hey, you want to hallucinate?" His name was Jack Frufrone Jr. I recognized him from sex ed class where we had just learned about fallopian tubes. He had a curly oiled mullet that was strangely mesmerizing and one of those downy molester mustaches that young rednecks like to cultivate. It was clear my teenage drug dealer had been held back a few grades. Frufrone Jr. tore off a tiny piece of paper and told me to put it under my tongue. I had no clue what acid was, but I was all in for adventure. He had handed me a tiny corner of a tiny square of paper. I looked at him and took the rest of the square, too. Soon, music was pulsating off the rec room walls, and my ears heard every little noise. I left the dance to wander the grounds. Trees started to breathe. My soft young mind was on fire. After the dance was over, my friend Linda took me home and dropped me on my front lawn where I lay tripping my brains out, pine needles in my hair, staring up at the trees. My mother came out, dragged me inside, and propped me up on the couch. Furious, she began the interrogation. "So what is it? Are you stoned?" I didn't even know what that meant. "Are you drunk? Are you high?" She kept pummeling me with questions, and I was so annoyed because I just wanted to feel the feelings that I was feeling and see what I was seeing without this rude interference. Since the acid had rendered me mute, I had to marshal the strength to speak. I managed to summon just two words. "Fuck you." It was like a silent bomb went off. I had never cursed at my mother. Major miscalculation. By this point, there was another man in the picture, my new stepdad, Steve. He was a mean, dry drunk. I remember him telling me that mosquitoes never bit him because he had mean blood. He was not at all into us, my mother's children. We could all tell he didn't want us to exist, but we did, so there was a problem. He was not kind to my younger brothers. Brutal. He didn't like me either because I could see him for what he was, and I was always trying to alert my mother. Steve saw his opportunity to get me out of his hair, and he jumped at it. He started in that I was a drug addict. I had all the earmarks of a drug addict because I like to wear all black and listen to the Doors. One hit of acid. One hit. I'm fairly sure it requires more to be an addict. 2 weeks later, my mother deposited me in a drug rehab program where I was locked up at age 13, my shoes taken from me to prevent my escape. I told the doctors that I had never taken drugs in my life beyond the one hit of LSD, and they told me I was in denial. Hats off to them, there was no way out of this one. My home for the foreseeable future was the top floor of Sacred Heart Hospital in miserable Eugene. The time I spent in rehab was both entertaining and monotonous. They taught us about drugs for about 4 hours a day, what the street names were, what the street value was, where you could get it, what its effects were. Everything you ever wanted to know about drugs but were afraid to ask straight from the authorities. What the fuck, did they want repeat customers? I was by far the youngest person there and soon became the ringleader. One time in the dining room, I snorted sweet and low sugar substitute to prove how tough I was and to piss off the nurses. I had never snorted anything, but I saw it in one of the hospital's educational films. That was maybe the most painful thing I've ever shoved up my nose, so the joke was on me. I can honestly say that sugar substitute is a real chemical. You probably shouldn't ingest it and certainly not snort it. The drain was vile. It tasted like rat poison. I managed to keep a poker face and refused to cry like I wanted to. Making it seem like nothing was probably the best acting I've done to date. The nurses were very unhappy. But I got a cheer from my fellow rehabbers. There was family therapy one day a week, and that was a joke. Everyone in your family had to tell you about how they were affected by your drug use. It didn't really work because I'd only done one hit of acid. Mostly my brothers and sisters looked confused. My sister told me just to say I was a drug addict that it would go easier on me. Once again, if I admitted to something that wasn't true, it would pacify those in power. If I admitted I was a drug addict, they'd let me out sooner. I thought about it, but no. Once again, I refused to betray myself to make my life or others' lives easier. I was furious to be stuck somewhere and under tight control. The amount of time I was supposed to be in there was dependent on my good behavior, but I knew myself, and I knew my attitude was not going to improve. I was the unit's problem child because I was, quite literally, a child. From what I could see, my behavior was never going to get better. The only way out was to escape. So I did. I had become friendly with our floor's janitor. He did not care at all when I slipped past him into the stairwell and even waved goodbye. I made it out onto the street and just ran. No small feat considering I was only wearing the hospital sock booties with the little gripper pads on the bottom. I wandered for a few blocks until I came to a coffee shop. I met a girl in the bathroom while piercing my nose with a needle, as one does. She helped me push it all the way through. Her name was Chloe. On the street, you meet people and they become your instant best friends. Chloe introduced me to two older punk rockers named Slam and Mayonnaise, total street rat degenerates, both in their late 20s. One had dark hair with big spikes, the other blonde with big spikes. There were lots of teen vagrants in downtown Eugene. I was hoping it wouldn't be my future. It was raining hard that night, and we all sought shelter under a church's porch. My bed for my first night as a homeless teen was the cold, wet dirt. It was the oozing mud that woke me up, seeping into my ears. My hearing was distorted, but I could make out some high-pitched screams that didn't make sense. I could vaguely see in the dim light that Slam was on top of Chloe. I didn't see Mr. Mayonnaise. To this day, I don't know if it was consensual. I hope it was. Once again, I think I was left alone because I looked like a boy. I remember feeling saved because I didn't have breasts yet. I slid out of there inch by inch, losing my socks in the process. My ears were killing me, and my vision was starting to double. Barefoot and covered in wet mud, the only thing I could think to do was deposit myself back at the hospital, so that's what I did. I collapsed at a nurse's feet, crying about punks and possible rape. No one believed me. No one would listen. I've never lost the wondering and guilt about Chloe. It is something that drives me to correct injustice. Everyone was very relieved to see me back, but 2 weeks and many educational drug movies later, I left again. My roommate gave me some shoes a couple of sizes too big, but better than nothing. I got three other patients to open an alarm door so I could leave in the elevator. This time, I escaped for good. My life as a runaway had begun. Being a runaway in Oregon is deeply unpleasant. There's the cold rain, always the rain. Wet jeans clinging to my legs, never fully being dry. And the hunger, I was starving all the time. There were times when I was a runaway that I woke up after having these weird blackouts. Once I came to while standing on an overpass, woken up because my shoulder bag and backpack had gotten hit off my shoulder and were flying down the road. There were times during difficult moments when I would disappear from my body. While my physical self was left to deal with the repercussions of what was happening, my mind was in another place, gone. That was my method of protection, floating up above, watching everything happen as if through a camera lens. It was not unlike the kind of trances I would go into later while acting, but that wasn't on my agenda just yet. I had no contact with my family at this point. I was just out there. No one was looking for me. I wasn't offended by the not looking. I was just on my own. It's funny, on the street, you just kind of fall in with other kids like you. The discarded, the uncared for, the lost. One night, in front of a Circle K mini-mart, I met a ghostly Nancy Spungen-looking young woman with a mane of fried white blonde hair. She told me her name was Tina, and she was a stripper. I had seen a classic film about the burlesque star Gypsy Rose Lee, so I was pretty sure I knew what being a stripper entailed, but when I asked Tina if she could spin her tassels for me, I was rewarded with a blank stare. She took me to her place, a small box of an apartment with mattresses on the floor and cheap stucco popcorn ceilings. I am not a fan of popcorn ceilings, but I had to make an exception in this case. Kindly, Tina said I could stay for a while. Christmas was coming, and even though I probably wouldn't eat that day, I did want a roof over my head. After a week, Tina told me I had to put in some money for the heating bill. Aw, damn, what to do? Aha, I decided. I was going to rob my mother's house. I made my way back down south to Santa Clara, hitchhiking through small green town after small green town. I finally made it to the house. I waited until I was sure no one was home and crawled in through the cat flap, as I'd done every other time I was locked out. The house smelled like Christmas. Fuckers. I picked through the presents, irrationally offended that none were for me. In the movies, the tear-stained mom would be on the national news pleading for her runaway daughter's return. In reality, there was no sign I'd existed. Merry Christmas to me. I loaded up the wrapped presents satchel style and shimmied out the cat flap. I thumbed a ride in a Datsun 280Z with a guy who looked like Weird Al Yankovic. He dropped me at Pawn and Such. I charmed the owner into buying some of my brother's Nintendo games. I got $27, enough for Tina's heating bill. I was punk as fuck. I've always loved adventures, tiny and large, and this was definitely an adventure. Tina didn't like me at her apartment while she was out, so at night I would go prowling. Usually I'd try my luck sneaking into gay underground warehouse parties where I became somewhat of a mascot. I would usually do the one hit of acid that I'd managed to procure, or later, one line of speed, because that was more readily available in the club, and I'd dance until I got kicked out. I would go up on the boxes and just dance like a little machine. That's where I could really lose myself. On the dance floor is where I could channel my fear, stress, everything. I could turn into kind of a dance robot and just move. Sometimes the guys gave me poppers and giggled when I fell over on the floor. I still favored boys' clothes and managed from what I could get at Goodwill to put together a Charlie Chaplin-esque outfit, trousers that were a little too short, and a bowler-type hat. I took my makeup very seriously. My staples, courtesy of Tina, were a red Wet n Wild lip pencil, Revlon Love That Red lipstick, and Coty White Rice Powder, which came in a beautiful round box with gold designs that looked like it hadn't changed since the 1950s. I ended up looking like, I don't know, maybe a cross between a geisha and Charlie Chaplin. Some nights I did full checkerboard makeup on my entire face. It would take 3 to 4 hours to do a full face of perfect checkers, the black with eyeliner, the white with a stick of pure white Wet n Wild concealer. Sometimes I did spider webs on half my face with my eyeliner. I brought it. One day, I decided to put some acting skills to use. I went to the police station and said I was a runaway, that home was Pocatello, Idaho. I don't know why I picked Pocatello. I think I'd always thought it was a funny name. I told the police that my mother had changed her phone number and I couldn't get a hold of anybody I knew. If they could just buy my ticket to Pocatello, I could find my way. Then I turned on the tears. They didn't know what to do with me. The cops just wanted me to get out of there. They got me a bus ticket. Very kind of them. There wasn't much to see in Pocatello, so after a couple of days, I went to the police there and did the same thing, and they bought me a bus ticket to North Bend, Oregon. North Bend is right on the ocean. I remember being out there on acid, sitting on a log and looking at the ocean. The next thing I knew, the tide had come in. The water got as high as my chest, at the height of winter, before I realized I was practically submerged. The problem with acid is sometimes you lose track of things, like, say, the sea level. I was so cold, my jeans soaked through. Sand went up inside of me. I didn't get dry for, I think, about 4 days, my clothes stiff and crunchy with sand. Next, I used my acting powers to get me to Las Vegas because I remembered that my friend Lara had moved there. Lara was staying with Bjarni from Norway, who was always trying to get me drunk. After about 5 days, Lara got in a fight with him and skipped town, leaving me alone with him. He took me to play Black Yak. He pronounced the J as a Y. I got away from him, too. Pretty soon, I tired of my little game, sobbing to the police for bus tickets and crisscrossing the West Coast, although initially I thought it was all very adventurous and adult. I did whatever I wanted, which suited me. But it got to the point where it wasn't so much fun anymore. Being hungry grinds you down. Being cold grinds you down. Shoving down terror and being brave all the time takes a lot of energy. I make it all sound like a madcap adventure, and it kind of was, until it got old. I woke up one day, realized it was Christmas morning, and I hadn't had food in 2 days. I was over it. At the end of my 13th year, I placed a collect call to my Aunt Rory in Seattle. I told her I couldn't do it anymore. I was tired. Tired of being hungry, being cold. She did the kind thing and took me in. She certainly could have said no. She sent me a ticket, and soon I was in Seattle, Washington. Brutality. My aunt lived in a handsome two-story craftsman home with her husband Dean and her newborn son, Austin. The only people who showed me any kindness during this period of my life were my Uncle Dean and Rory for taking me in. Dean was an honorable man from Indiana. He was handsome with green eyes, always a step away from laughter, totally in love with his wife. Dean never looked at me like I was a freak. He never put me down, and he smiled like he meant it. No one else smiled at me. But to be fair, I wasn't smiling much either. I kinda came in off the streets with a permascowl. My Aunt Rory was undoubtedly going through a lot at this time as she just had a baby. I really resented that baby. I knew I shouldn't, but I couldn't help myself. He had so many material gifts and so much attention showered on him that it made how I grew up look so lacking. This baby was safe. It made me deeply uncomfortable because I didn't know what to do with these feelings. I was ashamed to be jealous of a baby, but I had never been in a situation where there was extreme care of a child, where attention was paid and love was shown. I craved that kind of love, but if it had been shown, I literally would not have known what to do with it. My aunt made a big show out of spraying Lysol every time I touched anything. It was humiliating, one more humiliation to add to the long list. To be fair, I had come in off the streets with crabs in my pubic hair and ringworm on my neck, so I suppose Lysol was a good idea. The ringworm looked like someone took a cigarette butt and pushed it deep into my neck, a perfectly cylindrical shape. The crabs I discovered one day while on the toilet, I picked at a little brown dot in my pubic hair and it moved. It had little arms and legs. Holy shit, I almost passed out. When I was taken to the doctor for my neck, he promptly told my aunt about the crabs. So much for confidentiality. I suppose if crabs and ringworm were the worst I came away with from my stint on the streets, then I wasn't doing so badly. I'd managed to avoid or outwit the predators, the trolls as we called them on the streets, and not get molested, assaulted, raped, killed. I'd done okay for myself. One day, about a month after I'd come in from the streets, my aunt told me that my father was moving to Seattle. My stomach clenched. I immediately felt a deep sense of dread. The last time I'd seen him was after he'd moved to Montreal. He was growing more and more unstable. I knew his arrival would spell trouble, and I was right. I figured he had done something bad to my now ex-stepmom. Why else would he have left with nothing but the shirt on his back, his art supplies piled into a car, hauling across the country like a bat out of hell? Why else would he have deserted my two half-sisters? I knew he must be guilty of something major. As he got closer to Seattle, I felt the coming storm. My dad and I moved into a not-so-charming apartment he called The Cave. It was on the first floor, a dark, dark place with low ceilings, ugly parquet floors, and bad vibes. It must have really depressed my dad, because he'd lived in beautiful houses previously. The building manager lived above us in a hoarder's paradise. Our apartment was clean, but it was devoid of any kindness, which matched what was going on inside the walls. At this point, my father was deep in a rage he had had against women all his life, but now it had a clear focus. Me. He would go off on me and all women, calling me a feminazi. He sounded like your average schizophrenic on the street, arguing with some non-existent entity about women, except I existed corporeally. I've been dealing with men's hatred of me simply because I am a woman for my entire life. It all started with my dad. We were born enemies based on gender. His excuse for his rage, for every failure, was women. All women were to blame, therefore I was to blame. I came to hate him as he hated me. The worst part was remembering what a magical being he'd been when I was little. This monster in his place was the worst kind of betrayal. There are a few photos of me that exist during this period because my father said I was too ugly to photograph. After my years in Oregon, I was used to being called ugly. I would roll my eyes when he said that, but it still stung. We had no silverware at The Cave, or at least I didn't. I was told I wasn't worth buying silverware for, so I stole utensils from restaurants. I didn't have a bed because I was told